Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. From the platoon sergeant or the first lieutenant trying to work out what was on the other side of the hill, to the generals and field marshals planning grand strategy, the Second World War was fought using maps. But how good were these maps? How were those covering underexplored areas made, and how quickly could they be supplied to the men on the move at the sharp end? In this podcast, Professor Jeremy Black, author of A History of the Second World War in 100 Maps, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about a vital factor in wartime production that military history often overlooks.
Professor Jeremy Black, one of the extraordinary statistics that jumps out from your new book, A History of the Second World War in 100 Maps, is that during the course of the conflict, the United States Army Map Service produced 500 million maps, and the similar services of other major nations produce also very large numbers indeed. It's an extraordinary scale-up of production. When in the 1930s did that scale-up start to commence as the major governments realised there was a prospect of a major war ahead?
Well, it's an excellent question. And the answer is it didn't really till the war hit. And the reason is that although there were some preliminary preparations, nobody was at all convinced as to what the lineup of combatants was going to be or where they were going to fight. So to give you an obvious point, as I discuss in the book, I mean, for example, the Americans and the Australians had to campaign in New Guinea, much of which was very poorly mapped. Nobody considering war prior to 1942, when the operations began in New Guinea, and nobody considering it prior to that, assessing the prospect of war with Japan, would have assumed that the Japanese would have got that far. So there's a need for new mapping as you go along. And then on top of that, I mean, for example, if you're looking at the German-Soviet war, the Soviet frontier, the Western frontier, changes radically in 1939-1940 as a result of the annexation or seizure of territory from Poland, Romania, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Finland. So that, in a sense, the what you're going to fight over is changing, and the mapping therefore has to change. And also the war tests weapons systems in a unfamiliar fashion. So it's not clear beforehand what exactly you're going to be doing and requiring in terms of long-range bombing. So the assumption, if you're looking at American air power doctrine of the 30s, American air power doctrine, I mean, put crudely, there is some, you know, we're trying at every stage to make these things comprehensible, but the Americans essentially envisaged daylight bombing of heavily fortified aircraft formations, which carrying considerable defensive ordnance in the shape of machine guns in order to fight off interceptor fighters. Now, what you require, if that is your Air Force doctrine in terms of bombing, is very different than if you're envisaging bombing at night and if you're envisaging actually wanting the cover of darkness and maybe cloud in order to protect yourself against anti-aircraft fire and in order to protect yourself against interceptors. And, for example, in air power, the very innovation of radar, the fact that although radar was obviously envisaged and was being worked on before the war, the extent to which you're going to be able to get radar airborne in individual planes and then use it is one that really develops as the conflict develops.
Well, aerial photography is one particularly interesting area. What had been learned from the experience from the First World War in terms of using planes and photographs, but also more generally about cartography?
Oh, well, again, that's fascinating. Well, World War One, what a surprise, didn't work out as people had envisaged, in the sense that you move rapidly from a war of maneuver in which aircraft, in fact, helped to, as it were, scout the moves of other the formations of other powers, German advance into France, for example, or in 1915, Ottoman advance across the Sinai Desert, to moving to real, towards stationary front lines, in which aircraft become principally important for their reconnaissance ability to map in detail the stationary fortifications of the other side in order to prepare for fire plans, which are in effect map related, for the artillery of the attacking power. And that's very significant, and I discuss that in some length both in my history of World War I and also in my book Maps of War, which is a sort of mapping book on war across land warfare across the ages. But the point is that World War II does not really develop like that. Reconnaissance aircraft play an enormously significant role, but it's not because of stationary front lines in which they are paying a, in which you have a preparatory period of some weeks in which you take photographs, you evaluate them, you prepare the fire plans for the artillery. A lot of the land fighting is much more fluid and mobile in World War II. So first of all, you have to present your maps much more rapidly, as we discuss in this book. But secondly, I think it's fair to say that you are dealing with units moving at a greater pace, so therefore you need your reconnaissance and your mapping to cover a greater range of territory.
For officers in the field being issued with detailed maps of the area in which they're operating, would they sometimes be given an aerial photograph to work from, or would those photographs always be translated into maps first before being passed into the hands of the commanders on the ground?
Usually the latter, but sometimes the former.
Right, right. So it was on a needs basis.
A needs basis, speed, a whole host of issues are involved, and also what in fact you're trying to show. I mean, what's interesting is if you look at this book, and I use the term we because any book of maps, there is the author, which is myself in this case, and I wrote the book, I wrote the captions, I picked the maps, but then you need to have a production side where you have, in this case, there were two people, one who actually got the maps I'd chosen, which is actually, that sounds easy, it's not, it's bloody difficult. But secondly, you need very carefully to have layout issues which enable people to see what they the maps at the right scale, or the portion of the map at the right scale to make the points one's trying to bring out. And so therefore they're a collaborative project. And what I tried to replicate in that, and as you will know because you've seen the book, it operates at different levels of scale. So in doing that, I'm trying to replicate in the maps that I present, I'm trying to replicate the varied tasks which commanders and combatants had during the war. Now, the British Library very kindly allowed me 100 maps, and that's great. Inevitably, one could have produced hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of maps. So each individual map is designed to both be consequential in its own right, but all about mapping and about an aspect of the war, but also to try and introduce broader themes. So you're absolutely right. Aerial reconnaissance is very significant, but obviously what aerial reconnaissance means is different depending upon what level of warfare you're looking at and where you're looking and what the already existing nature of the maps of that terrain are. And the last point is very significant because in some areas aerial reconnaissance is providing information to add to already quite good maps, shall we say, northern France. And in other areas, your aerial reconnaissance is providing information to add to areas where the mapping is not so good. Let's say Libya, for example.
So let's say I'm, let's maybe Libya, but let's say I'm with the 14th Army in Burma. Lots of jungle everywhere, cartography not very good. I'm moving forward. I need more detailed maps than I have. Would I, you know, if I'm signalling back for more detailed maps, ultimately, would this be maps that go back and being produced in London? I mean, surely that distance is too far.
The British had, from before the war, the Survey of India, and they had the comparable thing in Egypt. So you have map-making facilities that are well-developed, really professional map-makers in India, and in effect, Burma, because it's part of the, you know, the British presence in South Asia, is covered out of India. There were already maps of India, of Burma, though Slim famously remarked that he always seemed to have to campaign at the edge of where the maps were, as it were, where maps joined. You know, a map itself, aerial reconnaissance is not, how should one put this? One's always got to get a careful balance between what technology can bring and what it doesn't necessarily show you. So aerial photography doesn't necessarily show you what was known at the time as the goings, the actual traversability of the terrain, which is very, very important, obviously, for vehicles, but also for infantry. As case of Burma is concerned, it doesn't show you the extent to which the routes that you might be able to discern are going to be affected by weather conditions, heavy rain, are going to be affected in the case of crossing rivers by spate after heavy rainfall. All of these are significant factors, so that there is a mass of problems that are, as it were, helped by the aerial reconnaissance, but not solved by it.
All the main combatant armies had similar approaches to having maps made, or did the different forces have very different approaches?
Well, that's something we discuss in the book, and I went into quite some detail in my research on it. I mean, of the major combatants, the weakest are the Japanese, and that because their prior mapping of the areas in which they're going to operate is very limited. Not surprisingly, these are territories belonging to other powers. But once they do take them over, the effort that they expend on mapping is well below what it should have been. Although looked at differently, if what you're preparing to do is to defend an island against an American amphibious assault, and you're fundamentally concerned to dig your troops in, actually, the map is less important than your commander who is on the terrain deciding that such and such a limestone ridge is one you're going to dig into and not the one next to it. So in a sense, the map is not necessarily going to take you too far. And situational awareness, as you can see, for example, famously at Midway, as to the location of the American attacking American planes on the Japanese fleet, that situational awareness is something that is very immediate. So in a sense, the mapping element there is not one of carefully prepared charts. But the Japanese are the weakest. The Germans are not particularly good. I mean, I draw attention to the very ad hoc nature of German mapping. As you will know, and we've discussed on a number of programs, German fighting organizational and other characteristics are classically exaggerated in terms of their proficiency. The best mapping powers were the British and the Americans in terms of flexibility, scale, the ability to produce and the determination to produce maps covering a whole range of topics. You know, so for example, I've looked at things like hydrology, at things like the rocks, the capacity of the local rock to take, you know, heavy aircraft for level runway construction, and all of these sort of elements. And of course, the Americans and the British, to an unprecedented extent, are operating around the world. I mean, so that they are having to produce not just of a great scale, but also in many different environments. And they are the major powers with long-range air movement and long-range air attack. And they're also the two leading naval powers. So it's not surprising. They have the greatest need. They have the greatest skill set, and they have the greatest output. And one of the ways, it's an aspect of the way in which the Allies win the information and intelligence war. And all too often when people talk about intelligence, they think, and you know, these are important subjects about things like ultra and magic, or about, you know, the GCHQ and all the rest of it. Those are important. But actually, mapping is a key element of the intelligence and information war, and it's one that tends to be underplayed. And that's one of the reasons why I think this is a very important book. It's not only a very attractive book, but it's a very important book because it actually tells you a lot about the Allied success, the reasons for it, and in a way, how you could almost measure it or calibrate it in terms of the quality and intensity of the mapping project. Another element I'd like to draw attention to is the way in which I try and add into the book maps of, if you like, reportage and propaganda. So I start off with the different scales, geopolitics, strategic, operational, and tactical, which fundamentally relate to combat and which indeed cover the majority of the book. But then I have three others, reportage, propaganda, and retrospective. Now, retrospective is the shortest of the lot. I could have done a whole book on that. But retrospective is how World War II was subsequently presented. And that's interesting because, in a way, that's one of the ways in which people learn or repeat the lessons they have given or politicized it. So, you know, I've got a Hungarian map from 1961 and a Romanian one from 1971 and a French one of the late 40s. And all of those are providing you with different accounts. But the reportage and the propaganda are at the time. And what they are designed to show is that maps were a very important element of the visual politics of the war. Both politics in terms of encouraging your own supporters, affecting neutrals. Hopefully, as I should produce some maps, for example, discouraging your opponents. So I've got some German maps used to discourage the Allies in Britain, in Italy, and an American comparable one to discourage the Japanese. And then there's also the extent to which you portray geographical linkage. So one of the most interesting ones are these American maps designed to sustain the view that America is not isolated by the Atlantic and the Pacific from the struggles in Europe and East Asia, but that in the age of air power, it is closely involved in them. And these maps, which are some of which begin before the war, but then very much are produced during the war, because, of course, the Americans go on having to persuade their public that they're fighting a meritorious war. Now, obviously, the Japanese at Pearl Harbor and Hitler by declaring war helped them immeasurably. But nevertheless, it is important. There is a concern always about war weariness. There are elections. I don't think there's any doubt that the success or in holding the Japanese in the Solomons at Guadalcanal is important to the 42 midterms, and success at D-Day is important to Roosevelt in the 44 presidential election. I don't think it would have been so easy for him. I think he would have had to win under different circumstances in 44 if there'd been a major disaster. And domestic public opinion is important, and that is the case for all the combatants. And so therefore, we have maps from the Japanese, from the Germans, but also, you know, from the British, the Australians, and the Americans, trying to explain to the public what they are doing, why they are doing it, and that they are doing well. All of those are very important. And then on top of that, which I think is very interesting, there are those maps like the American news maps that I show, which are maps produced for the troops. Because actually, it's not just that you're trying to maintain the morale of domestic public opinion, you're also trying to maintain the morale of the military. And people had very much taken the lesson from 1917 and 1918 that military morale can be febrile if things are perceived as going badly wrong. So that what you try and do is you try and bolster morale. So we have, for example, the map produced for the Ulm Division, showing its advance eastwards in the Soviet Union in 1941. That's intended to try and build up cohesion and a sense of achievement in the part of the unit. And there are other maps. Obviously, I looked at loads and loads of maps and just selected some. I mean, there are other maps which I didn't produce, which are similar maps for the Japanese in China, for example, and for the Americans in France and Germany. And again, that element, I think, is quite important. And it also tells you a lot, not just about the war, but about mapping, about how mapping serves an enormous variety of purposes. In doing that, I'm trying, with the looking at the war, to deliberately decenter it. There is, I think there's at least one historical atlas of World War II I know, two in fact I know, which are quite frankly plonkety-plonk books. In other words, we start at 1939 and we plonk through it in chronological order, and that is the narrative and that is what appears to be important. Well, actually, what I wanted to show is that you can use mapping to provide what was how the war was experienced, which was a series of different struggles for different combatants with no real central narrative, and that this actually is really interesting and also helps to explain why you have differing requirements for your maps. And the actual production process of this book exemplifies this, because we're talking about the British Library edition, which is the edition that's on sale in Britain, but the University of Chicago has produced the version on sale in the United States, and there is a slightly shorter version that's being produced in France as well. So what you're trying to do is to actually resonate with differing audiences, which indeed was the experience of the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very interesting subject, the way in which maps are used during the war for information and also for propaganda to non-combatants at home. I mean, the number of maps appearing in newspapers, I'm sure many adults in Europe and America probably hadn't seen as many maps since they were back in their schoolroom. And there's an amazing photograph, which I'd not seen before in your book, of Roosevelt sitting with an absolutely enormous globe behind him. I wonder if you can say a little bit about the way in which maps are used in this way, almost as propaganda tools, but also a little bit about Germany, about Karl Haushofer, for example, the German geopolitician, and how maps were used to give Germans a sense of their geopolitical destiny.
Yes. I mean, let's start with Roosevelt. First of all, Roosevelt was very interested in geography and very interested in maps. And this reflects back on his earlier career, including in the late 19-teens, early beginning of the 1920s. He'd always been interested in geography. And he actually uses maps to encourage the American public to look at things during his radio talks and to encourage this idea of the linkage of the United States with further areas. There is also separately the idea of the map, the globe, the atlas, as something that, as it were, exalts the statesman, that shows that you are a man of destiny. And in fact, at today's Times, we're speaking on Friday at the moment, so that's a week before this goes out, today's Times has a photograph of President Putin of Russia, interviewing somebody over Soviet plans on the Arctic to do with strategy and oil, and he is sitting there with an enormous map, and this is clearly designed to suggest that Putin is somebody who understands a geopolitical destiny for Russia, etc., etc. So it's a normal pattern to do that, but on top of that, some people understand geography. Now, I think it's fair to say, you asked me about the Germans, Hitler's understanding of geography was very flawed. I mean, he was a very stupid man. The fact that somebody seizes power or holds power doesn't mean they have any innate ability, anything other than seizing power. And he was a very stupid man. He didn't really understand much about geography, and he didn't understand very much about the connections between territory or indeed the frictions of distance. So, for example, about the difficulty that, even if the German force had advanced in 1942 to Maykop and further into the eastwards towards the more of the oil fields, the actual difficulty of moving oil to the Black Sea in order to then transport it. It seems to have been beyond him. So Hitler is rather flawed. I mean, I think that's a fair point to make. Both Churchill and Roosevelt are interesting because they have a geopolitical sense based upon an awareness of the interaction of the oceans and the land. Both of them, that's a characteristic, I think, of oceanic power. And obviously, in Churchill's case, Churchill is a man who, from very early stages, had acted in an imperial settings in southern Africa, in Sudan, on the northwest frontier of India. He has a strong sense of the reality that when you see something on a map, it is actually different. It's not just far away, it is different. And he, in fact, had a very sophisticated understanding of geography. Roosevelt's understanding isn't quite as sophisticated, but he does come in that tradition which looks back through Teddy Roosevelt, that looks back to Mahan, this tradition of navalism, of America as a two oceans power, and of the need to think through the implications of that. And he's good at that. Now, you specifically asked me about Haushofer. As you may know, I've written a book on geopolitics, so people who want chapter and verse can have a look at that. But essentially, there was a school of Germany played a key role in the evolution and development of geopolitics at the end of the 1890s, beginning of the 20th century. There was a school of German geopoliticians in the 1920s, most of them fairly conservative, among whom Haushofer was very prominent. A German general from World War I runs this geopolitical institute in Munich. And essentially, these were people who were arguing that Germany had been robbed of its destiny by the war settlement, that the Germans should try and recreate a line to a sort of Grosser Deutschland, a sort of all the Germans in one state, as opposed to the Kleindeutsch approach. And Haushofer has this notion, and in a way he's regarded as influential because people have heard of him, because he was close to Rudolf Hess, because he received honors from the Nazis. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that Haushofer wanted a kind of alignment between Germany and the Soviet Union, as was achieved in 1939. He was not favorable to what happened to German policy. And as you may know, his son was involved in the conspiracies against Hitler. His son was disgraced, of course, after Hess had flown to Britain. His son was involved in conspiracies. His son was executed, and the father himself committed suicide after the war. Geopolitics, I think, is interesting, but one of the great problems with work on geopolitics is that it's similar to work on strategy. All too often, people look at the thinkers, Clausewitz worship. What you actually want is the geopolitical awareness, understanding, knowledge of the actual actors. So it's more important what Hitler thought about geopolitics than what Haushofer thought. It's more important what Roosevelt thought than what Bowman thought. It's more important what Churchill thought than Mackinder. Mackinder's still around in the World War II. And I think the mistake is to focus all too often on those people who produce text as opposed to those people who are actually taking the decisions.
Just taking a step back to just before the war, to the period of appeasement and the Munich Pact in 1938, the maps that were drawn up of Czechoslovakia, showing Sudetendeutsch areas and so on, which were fundamental in Hitler's plans to subsume the Sudetenland and ultimately all of Czechoslovakia. What is really the history of the way in which those maps were created, and were they essentially German maps, very approximate, or were they a genuine attempt to pinpoint different ethnic groups dispassionately?
Well, it's not easy to do the latter. There's a very good book came out in 1951 by Wilkinson on the Macedonian problem, and it goes through in some detail some of the really major conceptual and other issues that are involved in this. So it's not at all easy to do this. As far as your question about the German mapping of Sudetenland, I mean, I reproduce in the book, for example, Siegfeld's map of the German diaspora in 1938, and, you know, very much presents an apologia for expansion. I mean, the reality is, it is not hard, unless you're using a kind of dot maps, dot system, choropleths, you know, in which you have lots of different coloured dots to try and capture the situation, or you have lots of pie charts for particular portions of what you're dealing with. It's not easy to do it. And if you're doing, as so often the maps did of that period, and indeed many maps today, you're using a two or three colour map, you're using blocks of territory. I mean, you can think of the way in which mapping was produced in the 1990s for these struggles in Bosnia. You can think about the way in which maps are used today to try and present ethnically complex areas. I mean, it's still a problem today. And I think, I used to teach a course called Maps and History. And if you'll pardon the use of the swear word, I used to say to the students, because obviously there is this tendency of technological triumphalism. It must be better now. We have computers. We can design the maps on screen, etc. This. And I used to say to the students, well, the way to think about it is crap in, crap out. In other words, if you produce a flawed data analysis, flawed data set, and then a flawed data analysis, then all you are going to do by producing a more attractive map, or actually a map with more bells and whistles, is make actually your mistakes or your flawed assessment, or let us use the term your propagandist assessment, seem more plausible. So I think one has to be very careful. I mean, as you may know, I've written many books on maps. You know, I would hope that most people interested in maps have read my Maps and History and my Maps and Politics and my Visions of the Past, and those are the three most important, but there are other books of mine on maps. And I've tried to show that one must be very wary of assuming that there is a clear set of criteria on which you can, as it were, give one map a mark for being 97% okay and the next map only gets 85%. I think one's got to be very careful in producing that approach.
Mm-hmm. Turning to an aspect of a campaign that never happened, the German invasion of Great Britain, how good were German maps of the UK in 1940, and beyond obviously some copies of Ordnance Survey maps they had? I mean, where did they get their information from? And if they had successfully invaded, I mean, famously all the street signs were taken down and road signs, would they have found their way around southern England quite successfully with the information they had?
Well, that's, again, excellent questions. First of all, there'd been extensive aerial photography. So, as you know, I've got in the book things like their Stadtplan, their town plan of Plymouth for 1941. That's pretty good. And I've got their the aerial photograph they're using for Liverpool marked up. That's pretty good. I mean, you know, there are mistakes. I mean, there are errors that they make in their aerial photography and their analysis of what they see. And I think I've got a map of London that shows that. If I didn't put it in, I mean, I've got one of London that shows that. But for air attack, not too bad. Although, you know, the practicality is that the ability at a plane going at a height under fear of attack and under ground fire with at the speed you're going at and using free fall bombs, then you know it can only take you so far, if you see what I mean. It's fine for area attack. It's not always fine for precision. So that's a point. As far as the landing on the coasts are concerned, yes. I mean, as you say, they've got principally British maps from before the war. That, again, is not unusual. So, for example, the first thing the British used when they were thinking about attacking Tobruk were the Italian maps of Tobruk. I mean, obviously, once the British had got them, they then produced their own maps. It's perfectly normal to use your opponent's maps, which is one of the reasons why the Germans invading the Soviet Union took great pains to try and seize Soviet map stores, and why Stalin took great pains to try and destroy maps. But I'm not sure, quite frankly, that it would have made much of a difference in terms of whether street signs were taken down. The major objective for that was the idea that the Germans would drop parachutists, and the idea was that making it harder for them once they had landed would be valuable. And I think that's true. Although I also think what we see from, for example, the Allied airborne assault on Sicily in 43, or the American droppings of parachutists near the Utah beach, is you get a dispersal pattern anyway, and that dispersal pattern puts a strain on the defense, even if your attackers are not necessarily exactly certain of where they ought to be. But in terms of the major problems that were going to face the Germans, were absolutely nothing to do with maps. The major problems that were going to face the Germans were they are going to be landing using air control of the channel, which in order to hopefully prevent a British naval counteroffensive. That, to put it mildly, was an enormous risk, not least because the British would obviously have fought hard. The British also would have had the great advantage at night that German aircraft would have been able to do very little. So I think that, you know, there would have been an exposed force landing on which also lacked the enormous preparedness that the British and American armies invading Italy in 43 and France in 44 had. And if you think about it in those terms, those are the principal risks for the Germans. Landing on the actual beaches, they would have been able to do, but assuming there weren't warships in the way. But once they were ashore, as it were, they had problems, and those problems were going to make not much difference whether they had an accurate map as what they're looking at 10 miles ahead, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking a lot about the accuracy of the maps, but I want to finish off by asking about the materials in which the maps were made up. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of millions of maps needing to be made at a time of wartime shortages, and obviously maps need to be hardy, particularly if they're going on campaign. What were maps made of? The different nations made them of the same materials, and how durable were they?
Actually, I mean, first of all, I'm not sure, let me make the point, I'm not sure actually that I would say they had to be particularly durable, because many of them were discarded as soon as they were used. No, I'm not sure I would say that. Often, though, it depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about, let's say you're in a warship, you might well have a set of reliable charts which are going to be produced on stiffened paper. You might then well lay an overlay on that, and on that overlay you will chart position. Then the next day you just chuck the overlay off. That's not a problem. In terms of the actual shortages of material for making maps from, no. I mean, you know, if you're looking at the great shortages of the war, the most important one, of course, is oil. Gas for American listeners, but no, not paper. You yourself mentioned at the outset the vast numbers of maps that were produced. Most of them were produced on paper products. You do have some on other products. For example, silk is used, as you may know. I illustrate a escape map. Air crew were given escape maps, which were readily fold-upable into much smaller things. But I would say that shortage is not the key element at the production side. data. And so we loop back to where we were at the beginning. Aerial reconnaissance is useful, but first of all, you've got to be able to have your aircraft up over the site. It's got to, they've got to be able to get back also, incidentally, and bring the film back. So it's not like today where they just need to transmit it. And they've got to be able to see. So I mentioned New Guinea, or we mentioned Burma. You tried doing that in the mist. So you've got real problems there. And then you've got, as we mentioned, the difficulty of assessing from the air what the situation is on the ground. So as you may know, I discuss it in the book, that, for example, after after the Tarawa problem for the Americans in the Pacific, they increasingly send in what the British use for D-Day, for Normandy, which are people on the, you know, who swim there using scuba equipment in order to report on what the situation actually is. What is the coral? How deep is the coral? What is the situation? And in the case of obviously Normandy, where there is no coral, obviously, what is the nature of the gradient of the beach? What is the beach material made of? Those are the sort of things that are really not readily, easily discernible from the air. So you often need agents, some form or other. These were very brave men who risked their lives. You need agents of some type or other who can tell you what the situation is on the ground. And as you know, for Normandy, for example, the British collected up postcards from before the war illustrating the beaches and such like. And let me tell you, that process goes on. I mean, a friend of mine in 2001 was interviewed about his recollections, including photographs of the recent trip to Afghanistan. I mean, these sort of things still go on. I mean, 1982 in the Falklands War, the British government took considerable pains to try and grab hold of mapping information and other information available on both the terrain of the Falklands and but also the immediate coastal waters. So only so much can be discerned from aircraft, or indeed these days from satellites. And that leaves aside another element which we haven't had a chance to talk about, but which at some stage maybe we could talk about, which is the human environment, the human geography. So, you know, we're talking about the war in the simple terms. There's us and them. Well, you start thinking about trying to work out, if you're a German commander or a British commander, how to make sense of the struggles within Yugoslavia. Who's on whose side? What do you do about mapping or understanding the sympathy of the Chetniks or the communists, or the same in China? How are you going to evaluate the likelihood of resistance activity? How do you map that? So there's a whole host of human environment elements to also consider when you're assessing things. And I mean, to my mind, one of the great problems is when we look at war, we tend to focus on the physical environment, which is obviously crucial. And, you know, mea culpa, you know, I've done my maps of war, my mapping naval warfare, my forts, illustrated history of, you know, building for defense, all of which are fundamentally about buildings and things, but also, of course, one has to bear in mind attitudes. What is the fighting caliber of that unit? How resistant are they going to be put up? What is the attitude likely to be of the civilians? If we advance through that area, will the civilians resist us, or will they just gawp at us? You know, these are the kind of things which you have to have at least a mental mapping of, which you might well then try and reduce to some sort of a form that you produce.
Well, all an interesting subject, perhaps for another day. For now, a history of the Second World War in 100 maps. It's a very handsome addition, but also a very, I think, important contribution to an area of the Second World War which often doesn't get the attention it needs to do. And I hope we've explored that today. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Many thanks indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.